I'm Mary Lowe. I have the pleasure of working with Alida Lincoln-Hammer. In saving Annabelle, Alida beautifully conveys an isolated world, a small Minnesota town before the turn of the last century, when no one moved around much. There were no cars to speak of, no phones. One's family was often one's whole life. I was amazed at the enormous amount of research Alida did while writing this book, and was privy to much of it when she turned in her artist statement. And her writing style was heavily influenced by the nonfiction book she read of this late Victorian period. Ornate and lush, it is one of the many strengths of her novel. As we watch the main character Greta grow up, we realize that all she knows in this isolated world of right and wrong, ethics and morals, is what she's seen happen in front of her and her family. I cannot forget the character of Greta, the sense that she's making her way the best she can in this strict and women-contemptuous world, dealing with not just a disabled sister and a crazy mother, but most horridly with a man who is struggling with himself and losing. Even when she knows things are happening that are very wrong, both by her innocence in sexual matters and her inability to conceive of a way to escape the situation, she is trapped and impotent. Until she isn't. This is an immensely powerful story of a young woman taking charge of her life in spite of the very world that created her. Please welcome Alida.
Thank you, Mary. I could not have had a better introduction to the program here at Hamlin than Deborah's core class. Thank you. And Mary Logue, my thesis advisor, Sheila O'Connor, my second reader, have both offered me their insight and their support throughout several classes and the thesis process. I am fortunate to have worked with two writers of such talent and generosity. I would like to thank my parents, my partner Scott, and our children for all of their support. Also, pieces of this book have passed through the hands of Hamlin's excellent faculty and my fellow students. Thank you for all of the honest feedback, and especially Nico, who has read more of this book than any other student, any other friend. So, as Mary said, the book is set in the Victorian period in the 1860s. I'm going to read the opening. The prologue has a narrator. Chapter 1, we go into Greta's voice in a first-person narrative. Prologue. The house is a bad house, and no one should mourn its loss. It does not matter that Edgar Jacobson, the town founder, built it himself. Do not regret that he designed it on a grand scale for a family of 10, and now it is gone. What does matter is that the unspeakable occurred within those walls. 3 stories of flame rise, lighting the starless winter sky. In a bedroom window, fire catches lace curtains. They billow before dissolving into flames. The fire eats holes in the walls. Were it summer, the sun and the farmers would be up, but it is late November. The sun is not due for over 2 hours, and people have adjusted their schedules. Even the farmers, who rise in the dark to tend their cows, claim an extra hour for rest in the winter. There is one person, the Reverend Williamson, who suffers from insomnia, who rises while the world sleeps to study his Bible. Today, a sense of unease draws him to the upstairs window that overlooks the river. Turning his gaze to the south, he sees an unusual red glow low in the sky, crowning the treetops at the horizon. The sight rouses in him a certain longing that he harbors with guilt to see the end of days. And then, as the red glow takes a new shape, he realizes what it is. The Reverend rushes forth in his slippers, nearly choking on the cold he inhales with shocking force. He slips on the compacted snow as he runs from one back door to another. Inside the vestibule behind the altar, he grabs onto the bell pull, jumping to extend his reach and using the weight of his body to start the bell swinging. The church bell is heavy cast bronze, a gift to the people of Landmark from the town founder. It rings loudly and forcefully, a resounding clang sure to travel. The alarm, three solid strikes of the clapper, a pause, again, again, again. Sweat trickles under the reverend's dressing gown. The townspeople come out, knowing there is nothing they can do. Winter has come with an early hard freeze, and the well water is locked under an inch of ice. Most of the men ride bareback, hurrying despite their helplessness, suspenders twisted in haste, trousers bunched up the top of their boots. Their hands freeze around the reins, if they bother with a bridle at all. While their breath is panted in frosted clouds that trail both rider and horse, like steam from a locomotive. Their horses are sweating from the run. Women and children, wrapped in layers of wool blankets, come behind the men, driving wagons and buggies. Only a few mothers with very young children and the very old fail to turn out. They find Maud Jacobson wandering the yard in her chemise and bare feet, a wrapper haphazardly slung round her shoulders. There is no sign of her husband or her daughter. The house disappears in a mountain of flame. The heat it gives off is not unpleasant. The colors, too. Pumpkin orange and brick red shifting and dancing against the navy black of the northern sky. The air fills with the sharp crack of wood giving way, of beams stacked with struts and shingles falling in pieces. The house rumbles and the roof crashes down. Women jump. Men clap hands on their sons' shoulders and hold them securely. Children cry. Horses skitter. It is a collective response fitting of such an ordeal. The ground vibrates as the ruin settles. The wind shifts and soon everyone is crying, if not from the spectacle of loss, then from the smoke that fills the air. It is a dense, choking gray. Dr. Bjornan remembers the bonfires of his youth and notes that this smoke is different, impure, heavy, and bitter. He decides it is from the various contents of the household burning together. All of the larder, furniture, books, clothing. And for some reason, he thinks of Maud's seldom-used parlor piano, its strings snapping from the heat, resounding one final strange note. The townswomen huddle around Maud. She is draped in a neighbor's brown blanket. Covered thus, she sits like a mound of dirt, unmoving. Maud, Maud, the women moan. They wring their hands and clutch at each other. She is in shock, says one. Maybe she does not know, suggests another. Mrs. Bjornan whispers to Mrs. Hansen. The poor dear is not in her right mind. She is lost to us for sure. And the news that Maud Jacobson is hopelessly lost spreads through the circle of women, their skirts brushing the snow-covered ground as they shift with the discomfort of it all. Poor Maud, they cry, knowing that her fate has cruelly turned. At the property's edge, far enough away to capture the entire spectacle, with his accordion box, Clovis Mendelssohn sets up his tripod. He disappears under the black cloth. His spindly legs and those of the tripod prop up the dark spider shape. It is the chance he has awaited. He is sure to include Maud prominently in the frame. The more pathetic and sorrowful the sight, the more certain his success. This is the photograph every newspaper in Minnesota will buy, and he will become a famous man for it. From the trees on the hill, one figure watches all as a single star appears over the pyre, high and faint. One star to guide the lost. Chapter 1. We can no more choose the family we are born into than a match can choose who strikes it or what it sets alight. This truism brings me no comfort, only a conundrum. It seems my life has been shaped by chance. I could just as easily have been born to different parents and had an altogether different life. Another view, however, considers nothing random. According to this view, God has a plan for each of us, and so, while I certainly did not choose my family, I was intended for them and they for me. Whether my life's course was thus set by chance or by divine intention, I cannot say. I find it is impossible to believe it matters one way or the other. I was born Greta Vanya Jakobsen, and that has shaped my existence in this world. Every choice I have made, every action I have taken, has begun with that solitary fact. My earliest memory is of watching a chick hatch. I remember the first fracture appearing as a jagged little line that spread across that perfect, smooth shell. I squatted in the straw and stared, afraid to blink for fear of missing the first miraculous appearance of a new life. The tiny beak broke through at last, then the head, skinny and wet with shining black eyes. When the chick had stepped from its shell, it looked at me and peeped, stretching its scrawny neck. It stepped toward me in a fumbling, unsteady way and toppled over, its tiny wings beating. It looked like one of the dead things our cats left on the porch, raw and exposed. Only the chick was not dead. It was insistent. I was considering touching it when my mother came into the hen house and stood over me. "Well, Greta," she said, "it thinks you are its mama now." It was not entirely different when my sister was born. Mother had a dream. No mere flight of fancy, but a tangible thing, a thing of beauty and hope. This dream filled her with a courage and light she had never known before. She told me the dream so often while working about the house that it became my favorite tale, and I learnt it by heart. Mother rose from bed in the middle of night and left Father sleeping soundly. She went out and sat on the bench under our biggest apple tree and gazed at the full moon, thinking how warm and peaceful the night. After some time, a light as bright as the sun flashed and a shape came toward her, but she feared not. When her eyes adjusted to the brightness, she saw that one of God's own messengers stood before her in flowing white robes with curls of golden hair cascading about his shoulders. From his back sprouted wings of snowy feathers, each plume as big as her hand. Mother slid to her knees so that she might receive God's word. The angel did not speak, and she opened her palms in supplication. In each of her hands, he placed a large, ripe apple, one red and one yellow. And so it was that God spoke to my mother and how she knew she carried twin girls. Mother immediately set to preparing for two babies. She instructed me each day how to care for a newborn so that I might assist her, although I was not even six at the time. She went about singing lullabies and talking to the unborn babes, whom she named Anna Beatrice and Belle Abigail. Then, with no way of confirming her intuitive dream, she ordered a brand new cherry wood crib. The day after we placed the order at Mendelssohn's Mercantile, she slaughtered a chicken. Together we went to the orchard and picked the finest apples from our trees. She dug potatoes and baked a fresh loaf of bread. The feast she planned for that evening rivaled Christmas supper. While the chicken was in the oven, Mother scrubbed me clean and put me in my Sunday dress with a proper threat of what would happen if I spilt on myself. I stood stiffly while she jerked a comb through my hair, afraid that displeasing Mother would spoil my chances of getting pie. At long last, my locks were formed into two smooth braids. All little girls are pleased by ribbons in their hair, and the ends were brought up so that they looped to my shoulders, and wide, grosgrain ribbons were tied around them. Father enjoyed his supper with the suspicious air of a hog being led to the slaughter. Mother fidgeted a great deal while he scowled at her from across the table. Finally, with half the chicken remaining, Mother spoke up. "Edgar, I have ordered a new crib." Father's mouth opened, then shut as Mother continued to speak. I am carrying your twins, so we will need a second crib. How do you know this, Maud? I had a dream. Father's face reddened as he curled his hands into fists on the tabletop. Helen, thunder! If there was one thing Father could not stand, it was putting stock in silly, irrational notions. Not to be put off by Father's vulgarity, Mother stood up at the table, her protruding belly pressed against it, nearly in the remains on her plate. Edgar Jacobson, I am carrying twins, and I need that crib. It will not go back. It most certainly shall go back, unless you have some kind of scientific proof to support that dream. I was visited by one of God's own angels, so I know that what I carry is of his will and your design. If that is not evidence enough, then shame on you. Maud, it was only a dream. A pretty dream you want to believe in, but that is all. No, Edgar. It was a message from the Lord to prepare for a blessing. Why, Maud? Why would you receive this so-called message? What makes you special enough that God would communicate with you directly? I dropped my gaze to my plate. Even at that age, I knew the tone Father's voice took when he was deriding Mother. I looked across at her. She retained her composure, and in fact, looked as lovely as I had ever seen her. I know what I know, Edgar, and who are you to doubt it? He blustered and threw his napkin down beside his plate. If this is some foolery, Maud, if you do not give birth to twins by God. He spread his broad hands on the tabletop and stood, pushing his chair back, then left the house. When it came to conflicting the two things by which Edgar Jacobson measured this world, science and religion, he could no more choose between them than he could deny God's existence above. And perhaps because he could not deny God, he denied so much else.